Yes, and it was Gandalf. Gandalf is the coolest. He is probably the most mysterious, but he's also the one that's clearly the most in control. Like, he has a plan and he knows what he's doing. And that's always, even if it's not who I always am, that is who I want to be 100% of the time. So I loved that.
Welcome to This Book, That Book. I'm Catherine Kwong. One of the things I've noticed about childhood is that it's only when we're younger we're encouraged to use our imaginations. My parents and teachers cautioned me on any media adaptations of books I'd read. They always told me the book and my imagination were better than what a movie could come up with. After seeing a few film adaptations, I realized the book was better. It was richer, had more developed characters, and was more fun to get lost in. My opinion was challenged when I watched the Lord of the Rings trilogy, and that's the book for today, The Fellowship of the Ring by J.R.R. Tolkien, chosen by my guest, Ariel Dyer. We talk not only about the first book, but about the other two books in the trilogy, and of course, the movies, which sparked a whole rereading and rewatching journey for Ariel. There will be spoilers. I'll make sure to fill you in with any details, so don't feel left out if you haven't read the books or seen the movies. I love this conversation, not just because I get to talk to Ariel, who is one of the most adventurous people I know, but because we talk about what stories mean to us, how comforting they are, and how they show us what living looks like when we're a little lost in it. Come join us and stay for a very special announcement at the end. Hello, Ariel. Welcome to the podcast.
Happy to be here.
I'd love to first just start off by hearing a little bit about you and how you'd describe yourself.
Sure. So I am a community events coordinator for Bitwise Industries in Bakersfield, California, but I do other stuff. So I write music, I perform music, and I also host a podcast, Not Your Final Girl, with two other women, where we talk about horror movies from an intersectional feminist perspective. I'm a degreed librarian to be, and I love genre fic, any and every type.
What is genre fiction?
That's a great question. Genre fiction is sci-fi, fantasy, speculative fiction. So things that aren't historical fiction or non-fic, all the weird in between, horror.
Okay, neat. For those of us that might not have grown up with this book on our bookshelf, maybe didn't encounter it till later in life, what is the story about?
Yes, we are talking about The Fellowship of the Ring by J.R.R. Tolkien. Fellowship of the Ring is the first book in a trilogy of books called The Lord of the Rings, and it centers around, it's a fantasy novel, it centers upon a particular hobbit who thinks himself and his life pretty insignificant and inherits a ring. Gandalf, a wizard, comes out and lets him know that not only is this ring actually pretty important, but the fate of the world may or may not hinge upon the destruction of said ring. So he sets out with some other hobbits. He reluctantly sets out. He wants to do everything by himself, Mr. Frodo. But he sets out with Samwise Gamgee, Merry and Pippin, and they all make it to a place called Rivendell, where many people convene to figure out what they're going to do. And they form the title of the book. They form the Fellowship of the Ring. So they choose several people. It's a company of nine. So including the hobbits, Gandalf jumps in. Two men, Boromir from Gondor, Aragorn. And then we have a dwarf, Gimli, son of Gloin. And we have Legolas. And I believe that makes up the company there. And then they set off to do this impossible task, destroy the ring if they can.
Cool. So, Ariel, tell me, how old were you when you first read this book?
I was in third grade. I was young. I was pretty young to be reading this book. I guarantee you I did not grasp it all upon first read.
I take it third grade, so it may not have been a classroom assignment. What started you reading it? Like, did you grow up in a bookish household? Did you see it in the library one day? Tell me a little bit more about you and the book meeting, your origin story, so to speak.
I did grow up in a bookish household. Both my parents were big readers, and I saw my dad reading The Return of the King. And I asked him, what is this book? I wanted to read what my dad was reading. So he told me, and he gave me The Fellowship of the Ring. And I love that he did that, because I feel like the reaction might have been, you know what, this is a little too much for you right now. We'll wait until you're older. But he just went where my interest was, and he gave it to me, and the rest was history. I read that one. I wanted to, of course, get to The Return of the King, the third book that he had read, so I could talk to him about it. And I kind of fell in love.
That's great. Did you talk to each other while you were reading The Fellowship of the Ring? Like, did you check in every once in a while? What was that experience like?
I don't remember particularly. I know we must have. We definitely talked about books a lot. And my mom would read aloud to us as kids. Not Lord of the Rings necessarily, but other books. So I'm sure we checked in about it. I know that he told me when I was in sixth grade, I think, the movie came out, the first movie. So I remember probably when I was in fourth grade or fifth grade, him letting me know, hey, this movie's coming out. We saw these.
Oh, that's exciting.
So we definitely shared the whole experience. And then when the movie came out, I fell even more in love, and it was just total obsession at that point. So yeah, this series defined definitely my childhood into high school for sure.
Got it. What were some examples of that you knew that it was like, definitely this was your thing, so to speak?
Well, I kind of roped other friends into it. We'd go to the premieres of the movies. Oh my God, in junior high, definitely wore my elven cloak more than
nice.
Once.
It's a practical piece of costume.
Yes. My best friend and I had buttons. She had a button machine.
Mm-hmm.
And we made buttons that had mysteriously would say something like 92 days or something. We had our own marketing campaign. People would ask us, what is this for? What is 92 days till what? And we'd say 92 days till the next Lord of the Rings film comes out.
Got it. You were tracking step by step, not a moment to be missed. Take me back a little bit to, I guess, like the experience of reading it. Are there any particular parts about the story or the characters that you remember standing out to you?
I loved, everyone bursts into song all the time. I think that's one thing we don't, if you, you know, think about Lord of the Rings, they certainly don't burst into song as much in the films, you know.
Oh, definitely not.
Everyone's a bard. They all have at least one or two songs plugged away that they can just perform at random. And it's kind of delightful. Sometimes they will just spontaneously compose music on the spot, which is also fun.
Right.
I remember that. I also remember, this maybe was a challenge for me as a young reader, was seeing names that I had no concept how to pronounce, couldn't at all, didn't know, pronounced them incorrectly in my head, you know, but something about how new that was. I mean, even they had, there's, you know, he invented languages. He was a linguist. So it felt like a rich world, and I'm seeing these phrases in Elvish and just can't believe it. You know, just that world sucked me in.
Oh, those are two great observations. And I think reading it a second time, I really paid attention to the verse more. And the fact that you're right, that it's not just dedicated to just like, that's the singing character. It's like they all do it.
Yes.
I know, like reading some books that I guess would have been considered a little bit harder in my own third grade, that was definitely something really interesting of like trying to figure out like, how do I say that word? And then, yeah, and that's like an interesting thing that films do for us, right? They kind of have to cement or define the way that things are pronounced too. Did anything change for you when the movies started to come out after you had probably read the series at least once by then as the movies started to come out?
It did change for me. And I'm trying to think how exactly. I remember this, like, the sensation I had after seeing the first movie and kind of the credits are rolling, because first of all, that was my first PG-13, and while Fellowship is not incredibly violent, and I on the regular watch far more violent, I watch horror films all the time for my podcast, but that was my first experience with any of that. You know, it was fantasy violence, but that was kind of a lot for me. But also, I had never before in my life, you know, had an experience where I had read a series and kind of treasured the series and then been able to see it on the big screen in a way that it's, I think the trilogy of films is practically perfect. I'm obsessed with them too. So the way that they take the books and they kind of translate them onto the screen, they made changes, but I think every change made sense. And even as a kid, I could kind of tell. I liked getting to point out, oh, well, they didn't do that in the book. Oh, what? This character is missing in the movie. What the heck?
Mm-hmm. Definitely skipped that.
Yeah. And you could be kind of a snob about it. So that was fun as a sixth grader. But it was also kind of comprehension of, oh, but I see why they made that choice. It's a different medium. So then I was kind of playing with...
Well, that's perceptive of you.
It was fun. It was a fun thing to do and to sit with. And I just, my jaw was practically open at the end of that film. That's when it became obsession. It was a series I liked and enjoyed, and it made it even better that my parents liked the books and I could talk to them about it. But then when I saw the movies, that was it. Then it was my thing. It was my thing, and I was going to be the best, and I was going to know everything about Lord of the Rings. And that was the end of it.
Okay. I'm trying to think. Was like Lord of the Rings my first PG-13 movie? Which I guess is not counting like the specific parts of James Bond that I saw on the television with my dad.
Those totally count.
Yeah, that totally counts. That's true. It was probably James Bond or like one of Jackie Chan's movies before Lord of the Rings. But Lord of the Rings might have been like full length feature film. Okay, so it sounds like you definitely kept track of time between when the next movie was coming out. Did that spur like rereadings for you, restudying of the text in any way? Did any things like that happen for you?
Yes, because The Lord of the Rings has appendices at the end, which have just a wealth of other information and history. You know, I found out, of course, there was The Hobbit to read. So you got to read Bilbo's story. But then there's The Silmarillion, which is practically a history book of Middle Earth.
Haven't finished it.
It is dense. Yes. Yes. I don't blame you for that. There's, you know, I got a book that goes through the grammatical breakdowns of the structures of Elvish.
Oh, that's fascinating.
Yes. Yeah, so there was a lot to review. There was a lot to go over. And I had... At this point, I had a couple friends who were very into it with me. So there was some fanfic writing. There was, you know, some art being drawn of our original characters. You know, there was a lot of exploration of the world.
And did you have a favorite character, or did it you at different times have a favorite character?
I loved the women in Lord of the Rings. There aren't a lot of women in Lord of the Rings. But the women that are there, I loved. Eowyn's my favorite character, 100%, which I know she's not in Fellowship of the Ring.
That is totally fine. For our listeners, Eowyn is a character in the Two Towers. She is from a human kingdom called Rohan, which is known as the Land of the Horse Lords. The people there, a lot of their culture, military style, and heritage comes from the breeding and care of wonderful, fast horses. Eowyn is the niece of the king of Rohan named Théoden, so it effectively makes her a princess, the shield maiden of Rohan, she is called. Her brother Éomer is a marshal in the king's army. And when we first meet her in the book, we find her in a somewhat distressing, confusing, and tense situation in which she is struggling to see the future of her kingdom as she watches evil counsel corrupt and weaken her uncle. Tolkien describes her character as being as beautiful and fair as like a mountain flower, but inside strong as steel. with those things in mind, what do you think was most compelling to you, both kind of then and now, about Eowyn's character?
I guess I'll just go with the amalgamation. I don't know if I could strip it away, but I don't know. There's a sense about her. I don't know if you ever read through a book or even seen a movie where there's a character who's not the main character at all, but there's kind of like a tornado. Like if you got close enough to that character, it would be about them. Do you know what I mean? Where there's just so much and you feel it and you kind of are getting sucked into it. And that's how I feel about Eowyn. When we first meet her, she's isolated. She's frustrated. She's in media res. Like she's right there where you want your main character. I want the Eowyn book. So I like that about her. I think she's really alluring as someone to get to know and to experience. I like that she's clearly strong. She has this is something that I've definitely outgrown as a plot line, but as a sixth grader, I thought it was so cool that she was a girl and she wanted to play with swords. And her dad was like, "You can't play with swords." But she was like, "Yeah, right, Dad, I'm going to play with swords because I'm a badass." Like, you know what I mean? It was kind of that vibe that was, I got in. I was like, "Oh, yeah, that's, I can relate to that."
But I loved how you made an observation that Eowyn seems like she could be the main character if the author had gotten close enough to her as a character, or if the story had shifted in a certain way. You mentioned that there was like a certain kind of like romanticism to her being like a rebellious, strong female whose dad wasn't super into her playing with swords, as something that you'd since grown out of. I'm wondering if you wanted to expand any more on that, or if there's more thoughts you had.
I was thinking about how unfortunate it is, kind of the pairing. So you have this really compelling, strong woman who is interesting, and then to kind of just have her hung up on Aragorn, she kind of moves on, but then they pair her up with Faramir in a way that feels just incredibly like a throwaway. Like, oh, well, Eowyn has to have some dude, I guess. Let's just give her Faramir, because Faramir's also alone and sad. It's something it feels almost like it's done as an afterthought. Certainly in the movie, it did not make it in, but it's an interesting commentary, and I don't know if it's necessarily, you could read it as sexist, but it also just feels like this ability, like, we need to pair people up with other people. That impulse in and of itself is also irritating to me. I don't think she needed anyone. I don't think Faramir needed anyone. They could have just been their own people. They could have been friends.
Yeah, could have been great friends. And Ithilien would have been no worse for the wear, I'm sure. I think it almost sounds in some way like simplistic in the way that fairy tales are, that it's like, and of course, because we have these two people, they will end up together at the end. And so that's when like the fairy tale bled hard into the end of The Return of the King.
That's true. It is. It's like the Jane Austen novel wrapping up, or the rom-com where the best friend gets paired off at the end, just obligatory. It has to happen.
Sure. Or they're like meeting somebody at the end, at the wedding, that it's like sparks.
Yes. Yeah. They catch the bouquet, and then Eowyn looks over at Faramir and he winks, and then that's going to be the thing.
And then credits.
Yes.
Do you think those are like realizations now that you know more about like romantic plots and movie structures? That's kind of something that you see now. Do you know if the fact that Eowyn ends up with Faramir, would that have made an impression on you the first time? Or like when you were in middle school reading that, like, did that bother you that she got paired off with Faramir?
I don't think so. I think when I was reading it for the first time, I just thought Eowyn was cool. That was kind of where it stopped. I didn't care about her being paired up. Like it totally wrote off, totally went over my head. The Aragorn stuff, who cares? The Faramir stuff, forget it. It was just all about her and how cool she was.
Awesome that she survived at the end. Yeah, that was huge. Okay. And that's fair. Yeah. In terms of when you read the first book particularly, was there a member of the company or any character in the first book that you were not necessarily in like the words of like, that's my favorite character, but particularly intrigued by or like noticed more in the story?
Yes. And it was Gandalf. Gandalf is the coolest. He is probably the most mysterious, but he's also the one that's clearly the most in control. Like, he has a plan and he knows what he's doing. And that's always, even if it's not who I always am, that is who I want to be 100% of the time. So I loved that.
I'd love to hear like a little more about that. Is that like an aspiration? Is that like one of the characters that you think of when it's like, if only I had this person here to help solve a problem? I'd love to hear if there's more behind that.
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, sometimes in like really cheesy moments where, you know, you need like extra guidance, I definitely have that line from the movie, the Fellowship movie, although it is said in the book at some point. The quote is, well, Frodo says, "I wish it need not have happened in my time." And Gandalf says, "So do I, and so do all who live to see such times. But that is not for them to decide. All we have to decide is what to do with the time that is given to us." I think Gandalf is definitely full of those kind of little bits of wisdom, for sure. And I love that about him. But I think what I like about Gandalf, first of all, he always has a plan. He's always doing something. And I love both of those things. But I think also the fact that he is this, you know, really cool, you know, once you find out the deal from Gandalf and just that he's this really powerful being, like he's not even human. But he hangs out with hobbits. Like, that's where he spends his time as opposed to anything else. And it's not even just, not in a way where he deigns to spend time, you know, Saruman's very derogatory about him hanging out with halflings, but he insists that there's something to be learned from them that's incredibly valuable. And so for me, I guess that's what I like about him a lot, is he's someone who is, you know, has vast superhuman amounts of intelligence and physical strength and prowess. You know, he's got it all. And more than anything, he'd rather be smoking a pipe in Hobbiton with the hobbits. That is great. Like, that's, I aspire to that, because sometimes I think it's really easy, maybe for all of us, but like, to get caught in the grind of, I want to do this, I want to do it well, I am a cog in the machine of capitalism, and I will do my job and I will get paid. To be good and to be powerful and successful, but remember that it's really meaningless in the grand scheme of things. Like, what really matters is kind of the relationships you cultivate and that sense of kindness that he has.
That is great. I just love that contrast that you brought up. And it also just makes me think too of like the visual imagery we have for wizards a lot is like they're old bearded men most of the time. But to see somebody like Gandalf, who's like playful, and I feel like the films really brought that out too, in the first film with his little fireworks and things, that he could be playful, and have interest in hobbits. I love that contrast there. Let's see, I guess in reading the book, it's no secret that Gandalf is by far the oldest and most experienced character, and the kind of, if there were a twist in this book, so to speak, even though it's the first book in a trilogy, it's that Gandalf heroically sacrifices himself to save them from what is basically a fire demon in the mines of Moria so that they can escape and continue on their journey. The death or loss of a character is always a significant part in books, and the fact that this one happens like sort of towards the end, did that strike you particularly in any way when you were reading the book as like a sixth grader?
No, it didn't. Not in a way that I remember. I do appreciate and kind of remember the characters go through a lot of grief after that moment in a way that I don't know if I'd ever seen up until that point, you know, in my reading. So the death happens in the rest of the book, even though they're pressing on. So it's not just, oh, we're sad right now after that scene, you know, they've moved on to Lothlorien, and someone asks Legolas something, and he's like, the grief is, I don't want to talk about it. I can't, it's too sad still. And they're still talking about it later. Like, he still feels present, in a way, he's in his absence. They always talk about him. He's brought up in almost every scene. And you mentioned how they're always like, Gandalf's the man with the plan. And even later, you know, Aragorn kind of takes up that role of leader, but he even says, he says, I don't know. I don't have the plan. I don't know what Gandalf was thinking. So we have to go on our own right now. We have to figure it out. But it's just, it's very, he feels like a ghost still in the plot. Which is interesting.
Gray ghost. Yeah, that's true. Yeah, he's extremely present. There's another elven kingdom that they come to after getting out of the mines. And the elves there, like, sing songs about Gandalf and the name that they have for him. And yeah, it's true. They keep bringing him up as like a resource or just a word of wise counsel that they wish they had. I think I'm just interested in timeline. So what grade were you in when the Two Towers came out?
Oh gosh. So if I was in sixth grade when the Fellowship of the Ring came out, okay, the Two Towers came out in 2002. So that would make me, seventh grade. So it was sixth, seventh, and eighth. I think they came out those years.
Oh, okay. Wow, you don't have to wait very long at all. Man, we wait so long now for things. okay, and then didn't the Return of the King came out like 2-ish years after that? Is that right?
The Return of the King, I think, came out in 2003. Yep, 2003.
You just had to wait another year for the next movie?
That's it. They had them all ready to go.
What?
Yep.
What an awesome time middle school must have been then for you.
It really was, yes.
That is great. And then when it was like done, was that, I don't know, was that a disappointment of any kind? It's like, and it's done and there will be no more? Or was it just like you rewatch and then there was the director's cut after that? Or the extended edition, I think is what they call it.
No, it was pretty heavy for me. Yeah, we mourned the loss of more Lord of the Rings coming out for sure.
Okay. So how did you talked about it being a defining element, this particular book and this story of your childhood. Did that defining element endure in any way as you kind of continued to grow up? Did it show up in any particular ways in college or like what you chose to study then?
Well, I don't know if it impacted necessarily what I chose to study. I was an English major, but at that point I loved reading and writing. It was what I enjoyed most. So it kind of made sense to me as a subject. It did. It felt like Lord of the Rings was a friend that I would just take everywhere for sure. While I didn't, you know, wear cloaks to my college classes or anything like that, it was definitely a series I still would revisit, and people knew about me that I was very, like, very obsessed and don't go toe-to-toe with Ariel on Lord of the Rings. Yeah.
Are there any other endearing themes that you noticed in the book this time around reading it?
Cracking up at my read-through this time, because a lot of this book is them being lost. They're just like, I don't know, we went on this trail and it's different. And it made me laugh a lot because I think, first of all, I go hiking a lot now. Like, I'm a pretty avid hiker. And so much of hiking is, oh my God, I read the map. I did this. Like, I looked at the forums. Why can't I find the trail? Or why is there a split in the trail that I didn't know about? But it happens. Then my reread was hilarious because they're always lost. They're constantly lost. Even Gandalf, the know-it-all, is like, I don't know, I just went by my nose. This path smelled better.
And exactly. And I think that's a point in the story where the company realizes they could be well and truly lost underground without Gandalf. And they're relying on him so much to help them get through because it's like dark and claustrophobic and there are dangerous things lurking there. And there's just so much uncertainty about what is the right way to go. That actually reminds me a lot of one of the first things that we ever did together. We were on a study abroad semester. I wonder if you probably remember this. We went on a hike in the Lake District and we started hiking at like 5 o'clock at night, but you know, it was like a late fall day. So there was a lot of light in the sky, and it was like this loop trail to a lake called Easedale Tarn. Beautiful, beautiful, quiet spot. But like on our way back, of course, it started to get dark. And I was the only one who had a headlamp. So I was out in front and, you know, kept shining on all the eyes of these sheep, which was freaking me out. And we got like lost in a bunch of ferns and tried to find our way back. And I thought we almost walked off a cliff at one point. But you definitely encouraged us to keep going because the trail was a loop. So you were convinced that if we just kept going forward, we'd end up back in Grasmere where we'd started, which you turned out to be right. It took us till 10 o'clock to get back, but it was probably one of my favorite experiences and one of my most terrifying experiences on that study abroad semester.
Man, you know what? It's so funny because I remember this as you tell it, but all I really remember is we went on a hike and we had a nice conversation. I don't remember, like, if you were to ask me to tell that story, it would not have been nearly as vivid as you just gave. So I'm happy to hear and be reminded that I've always had really bad hiking luck. So I'm sorry about that.
The sensory nature of the experience was also like something that had stuck with me a lot. And what that makes me wonder is, like, I'm probably at that point, I was not a person who'd been on a ton of hikes, but it sounds like hiking is definitely like a thing for you. So do you think possibly that the hiking misadventures you've had have kind of conditioned you to the possible uncertainty of getting lost?
I think so. Yes. I was actually just talking about that today because since I'm a horror fan, like Blair Witch comes up very often and people were talking about Blair Witch. And, if you know anything about that, people get lost in a forest. And so that's something that often comes up on hikes that I go on where, well, just that people, lose faith in the trail. And so if it's a loop or something, the idea is, well, let's just go back that way. And I'm like, no, we can make it. We can find a way. But the panic sets in.
Sure. Like if it's true, the security of going back through something you've already gone before is probably super tempting rather than to take the loop in an uncertain circle.
We've all, like, if you've ever been that one on the hike that kind of knows the trail and, you know, has the map, I've had many instances where other people are frightened or frustrated at the trail. So sometimes they're just mad because it's like a hard trail, which is totally fair. We always joke about, we all have a point where we start screaming obscenities at the mountain. So my friends and I that go hiking, we've all reached that point at different trails.
It makes sense, but I mean, it happens in the book too, right? Like the company discusses which is the best road and they all have ideas about what is the best way. The theme of finding the right way and knowing what is the right thing to choose in the moment is a huge part of all of the direction things and getting lost.
They're constantly, you know, even like once they leave the Shire, all bets are off. They don't know where they're going. Frodo thinks he took a shortcut and Merry and Pippin are complaining. And also the obsession with food, by the way, there's so much mention of food. You know, they're complaining, why can't we stay for breakfast? You know, and Frodo's like, well, we might die. So it's either eating your delicious breakfast or saving our lives. Yeah, they do get lost. It's just frequent. It's just, and it's kind of comforting. If Gandalf can get lost, then I guess I should feel okay getting lost a little bit.
Sure. I guess thinking about your life now, in general terms, like in what ways has the book continued to endure for you, or has its place in your life changed in any way now that you're more grown up?
Well, I hadn't read this series for, I think, at least probably 10 years until you approached me and asked me, oh, pick a book. And I agonized for a bit over the choice and realized that there really was no choice. It had to be this. So it is interesting to read it after having not touched it for a decade, because you would think, or at least I would think, that it would be kind of very new to me, but I intimately remember it even still. You know, there's lines that I remember, there's moments that I remember, like emotions come up, and so I think I don't think about it as much as I did, like certainly not, but there's aspects I have, particularly in viewing things like nature, and just the idea of journeys in general, definitely have a sense of romanticism about them, for better or worse, and that is something that's definitely from Lord of the Rings that has endured for me, that I didn't realize until this reread.
Got it. Can you tell me a little bit more about the romanticism, for better or worse? What do you notice there?
Well, I, you know, there's also, for me, I tend to be really, I tend to be really, externally motivated. So give me something like a quest or a deadline, something to get done. And I'm not saying that comes from Lord of the Rings. That's just me. But I think that's part of why I resonate a lot with that idea of a quest and that black and white issue, because, you know, the older you get, hopefully the more that you understand that it isn't a black and white issue. There, you know, there is a lot of gray area. The world is the gray area. And that is something I've learned and grown from, because the Lord of the Rings is so comforting in its, this is the good and this is the bad. And the world is not that.
There's something very safe about the Lord of the Rings, or sometimes in fantasy, that the world is very clearly black and white. And that reality, on the whole, is just a lot more gray. So there is like a certain settledness to the story being like, this is good, this is bad. Reality being a little bit more gray, and maybe like a little bit of romanticism associated with that. That was an observation that you made. Curious to know if you have additional observations for that concept, maybe.
I think that with Lord of the Rings, it certainly caters to kind of black and white, good and evil. I mean, it's an epic, and I feel like a lot of times epics tend to speak in that kind of language. But so there's that, and that's very true and very valid. And then the other side of it is that there's also something in there that's still, first of all, it is sometimes nice to just pretend like that we can see the world that way. But there's also this other bit about Lord of the Rings that stays with me too, especially now that I've grown up, because when I was young, you know, epic battles against evil, that sort of thing, incredibly appealing and easy to kind of to jump into. But now I feel like the thing that sticks with me as I get older is this sort of the things that are quiet, I guess. So, the thing that I mentioned about, I mentioned with Gandalf, you know, all he wants to do is hang out with these hobbits and get to know them and smoke a pipe. And I think that's not just Gandalf. I think that's kind of the book. So, you know, the ridiculous notion that we're going to give this MacGuffin, this ring, to a hobbit and just assume that he's going to be able to face insurmountable odds. And he does. And he does it with the help of his friends and his companions. But also, you know, of course, he does it because it's almost like a least of these kind of thing, right? Like, it's someone who just really couldn't care less about all these things, isn't bothered with power. Yes. Yes. And had no stake, but also just is so what someone else, you know, what someone who's higher up might consider insignificant, right? He's just, he doesn't matter. And so that's what's cool and radical about it, is just you can take this narrative that's usually reserved in traditional fantasy, often reserved for someone that matters, right? For King Arthur and his knights. And then you put it in the hands of this of Frodo and his gardener, and they just kind of go on this journey, and they do it. And so that's what's really it sticks with me and is important to me and is something that I feel is more enduring than kind of the good and evil epic story. It's just the quiet. And if, in fact, it's why they do all that for that moment. They do that for Hobbiton to come back. And of course, when they do come back, it's not quite the way they found it. There is really no going back in that way, for especially for Frodo. But they have a reason. They have a goal in mind, and it's just to be able to eat food and sing songs. It's something too that I think about a lot now, because it's now we're kind of towards the end. People are getting vaccines. We're gonna, you know, some of us are fortunate to still be working from home. Others, of course, are not and have not been fortunate this whole time to be working from home. They can't. But just that idea of, like, for my job, I'm an events coordinator. So my job is to put on events where people show up. And obviously right now, for many reasons, like, I have a lot of misgivings and kind of like that feeling of, not just with that job in particular, but just with the idea of labor in general, I just feel so disenchanted with things like us having to go to jobs to survive. And so I feel like Lord of the Rings works really well with that, because that's not what it's about. You know, it's about hanging out with your friends, and that's all I want. That's especially now. We've seen some of the worst of humanity in these times, and I want to hang out with my friends. That's all I want.
Oh, for sure. And I think what you say points out something really valuable that I think a lot of people sometimes write off fantasy as escapism, but it really depends on one's perspective. I think for sure if you see the world like dominated by these engines of capitalism and consumption, then my goodness, yes, you'll want to step into a book that's going to remind you that life is worth living because of simpler things like friends and a good meal and songs and a pipe. And like, you could have the top star like LinkedIn job, but the people that you want to be with at the end of the day are your friends. And again, I think Lord of the Rings is a testament to how books show us those things that really matter. So yeah, 100% echo that. And when you think about reading and like where you go in your reading life, what are some of those ways in which, I guess, like, you're just trying to be intentional about reading other voices or other people within genre fic and fantasy?
Yeah, actually, a few other librarians and I got together to make a new book club recently. We call ourselves the Radical Dystopian Readers, and we have a whole manifesto of rules. But one of the chief rule being, we will read genre fic. We will only read genre fic, and we will only read genre fic that is. There's a whole myriad of people and worlds out there. We've read enough white male authors. We're not going to be doing that. We're going to be reading everyone else, the pantheon of amazing authors that we can discover. So we're reading a lot of new stuff. We just read a couple of months ago, we read Binti by Nnedi Okorafor. Sci-fi, really short. It's a novella. I believe the audiobook is maybe only 2 hours long. Really beautiful sci-fi. Feels a little, reminds me of Star Trek, honestly, and it's, in its themes.
What is your book club currently reading?
I love that question. That's such a good question. We are reading Plain Bad Heroines by Emily Danforth, I believe.
Neat. Okay. If you could dedicate this conversation to someone, who would you dedicate it to and why?
I think I would have to dedicate it to my parents, because I don't know if I would have read it without, certainly without my, I wouldn't have read it in that moment if my dad had not been reading. And they both
They were strict, but they also kind of let me follow my own interests and my own, even if they were above my perceived reading level or abilities. And I appreciate them for that. I think I learned a lot because of it.
That was fun. Thanks so much, Ariel, for sharing the Fellowship of the Ring with us. It was great talking to you.
Yes, thank you for inviting me to do so. It had been too long since I read it, and it had been too long since I got to speak with you. So thank you.
Thank you so much for listening to our conversation. As always, if you want to read more stories by J.R.R. Tolkien, check out your local library or bookstore. This Book, That Book is a podcast created and hosted by me, Catherine Kwong. The announcement that I have is that this is actually the last episode of season one of This Book, That Book, and I look forward to bringing you more episodes, more interviews, and of course, more books later this year for season two. So please keep an eye on our Instagram at This Book, That Book podcast for updates on the second season. By then, I hope to have an updated logo and hopefully an updated website. You can continue to subscribe to the show or catch up on episodes anywhere you get your podcasts. Theme song for This Book, That Book is by the artist Lawn Games. The song title is Lovely Ghost. The current podcast logo is the work of two artists, Alyssa Beckew at Slightly Translucent and Anthony Guerra at The Fool's Art on Instagram. This is also the first ever episode that will have an accompanying bonus episode. Ariel is a podcaster herself and has a fantastic podcast with a good friend of hers where they discuss horror movies. I took the time to interview her later, Ariel's origins with horror, and a couple of episodes she recommends. So please be sure to check that out and subscribe to her podcast, Not Your Final Girl. More information in the show notes. That's all for today's episode. Thank you so much for listening. Keep reading, and I look forward to seeing you all for season two.